Well, if you've been watching what do you call them? The hearings, the congressional hearings for the president-elect's nominees for his cabinet positions, you really begin to understand we expect a lot. What those people go through, the grilling they go through with these senators asking them all of these questions. And you become to understand, you know, what we're asking for is make us safe. We want to be safe. And we're asking them, make us healthy. We want to be healthy. And we're asking them, make us rich. We want to be rich. What's wrong with those things? Health, riches, safety. That'll satisfy us. And one of the reasons our political debates get so heated when we talk to each other about them is that we really do look to the government and social institutions to give us what our heart really craves, and that's satisfaction. There's something in our heart that says, I want to be satisfied, I want to be happy, I want to be safe, I want to be, if I can't be rich, I don't want to be poor, and I want to be healthy. Where am I going to get that satisfaction? Well, maybe these guys who stand up and promise us those things. But the wisest man who ever lived said, you're looking in all the wrong places if you really want to be satisfied inside. There's only one place you can look, and it's not government or social institutions. This comes from Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Beginning with verse 8 and 9. We left off last week with verse 7. Now we'll pick up with verse 8. And what he's going to say here is that your ultimate satisfaction, the thing that's really going to give you a peace of mind, isn't going to come from your government or the social institutions. Look what you get. Verse 8. If you see oppression of the poor and denial of justice and righteousness in the province. Well, we do see that. If you see oppression of the poor, you look around the world and it's very clear. There are rich people who oppress the poor. There are rich people who own the companies who put the workers into subjection to them. They don't share their wealth with them. They subject them. And he says, when you see that, and by the way, it's not unknown in this country. There are people, you know, it's too easy to say, hey, this is the land of opportunity, and if you don't make it, it's because you're lazy. That's just not always true. There are people who are born in poor conditions that feel obligation to their family, and they have to work hard just to keep the family alive. They don't have the opportunity to get a master's degree or a PhD. They're stuck. Well, if they were more in debt, yeah, fine. You go walk in their shoes, and you see how easy that is. If you see oppression of the poor and denial of justice and righteousness in the province, again, we are so blessed in this country that the extreme of poverty in other countries doesn't much affect us, doesn't impact us. Cliff said in his class this morning, every one of us, by comparison, is rich. And we haven't experienced the oppression of the poor. And this idea of denial of justice and righteousness. I read a statistic that in India, guess how many people are waiting for trial? 30 million people waiting for their trial to happen. Guess what? It's not going to happen. You can't outlive that amount of time. You can't live long enough before your case will come to court. And he's saying, when you look to government or you look to social institutions, as good as they are, as wonderful as they are in this country that's immensely blessed of God, if you see oppression of the poor and denial of justice and righteousness in the province, do not be shocked at the sight. Don't be shocked. 30 million people waiting for trial. How could I not be shocked? And what he's talking about is don't go, oh, God, things have gotten off track. God, this world that you created, it's full of poverty, it's full of injustice, something's gone wrong. I'm shocked that a God who is almighty and he's all-powerful and he's all-wise could have let this happen. I'm shocked that God Almighty hasn't controlled things better than he has. He said, don't do that. Don't think that because in our estimation, and it's a proper estimation, there's too much poverty and there's too much injustice, yeah, of course. But don't think it's God that has missed the boat. Do not be shocked at the sight. For one official watches over another, and another official then, and there are higher officials over them. He says there's a very inefficient bureaucracy here where people do the best they can, but there are people up there and they're demanding stuff, and people above them. And he says, now think of this. Look at the next verse, verse 9. After all, a king, I take it that he's saying the highest in this bureaucratic mess, a king who cultivates the field is an advantage to the land. That is, the guy, whoever our governor is, if he came and he walked around with me for a week, he'd understand what the issues of a pastor are. He'd know. He thinks he's got a tough job. He should come here and bail a while. A king, someone who's in authority, if he cultivates the land, if he's down there with the workers, if he knows what it takes, if he knows how hard life is, that's an advantage. And he's saying, God knows. He was here. He experienced injustice. Personally, he wasn't just up in heaven and looking down and saying, my, tish, tish, tish. He said, I will take a human form and I will experience the greatest injustice of all, the best man ever to be murdered like a drug pusher or a criminal. If the king knows, it's an advantage to you. And that's an encouragement. He's saying, God knows because he's been here and he's walked in your shoes. He knows what it is to have somebody pass over you and give the appointment to somebody else. He knows what it's like to be poor. He knows what it's like to have injustice. And it matters to him. Don't be shocked. Nothing has happened that has fooled God. Nothing has happened that causes God to say, I don't know how we're going to get out of this. Or even to say, I don't know how I let it get so bad. He said, first of all, don't be shocked. You can look around and you see all this junk going on. God knows. He knows better than you do because he walked in all of these areas that you haven't walked. And he's also saying, that's not where you look for satisfaction. To the king, to the authorities who have this bureaucracy thing, regardless of how wonderful their promises are, he says, that's not your hope. That's not your satisfaction. We have a natural instinct to want it to be the answer. He says, that's not the answer. Here's another thing that's not the answer that we generally look to. If I just had enough cash, my problems would go away. Verse 10. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money. He loves it. I want it. I'll work for it. I'll give my life to it. I will focus on it because if I get enough, I will be happy. It will solve my health problems. It will solve my social problems. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. It's not that you don't have enough. As Cliff said this morning, who's richer in the earth than we? This too is vanity. It's like a vapor. If I had enough money, and it's like a dream. There's no substance to it. It's simply not true. Verse 11. When good things, this is why money doesn't satisfy us. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. Some of you don't have a weight problem. I do. And I know. The more I eat, I say, I'll just eat enough to really be satisfied. It never happens. That first pint of ice cream, well, that was just good. Here's the next, and I'll really be satisfied. I'll really be satisfied. Your appetite increases. Some of you know what I'm talking about, some of you don't. But he's saying that's true when it comes to money. You'll never have enough. It's like the reporter that asked John D. Rockefeller, the chief of Standard Oil, how much money, since they knew he was a rich man, how much money does it take to really be satisfied, John? And John said, just a little more. That's what it's like. You can't look to something for your satisfaction if, when you get that, your appetite for it has increased. And he says, that's the way it is with money. The more you have, then that's good, but I'll really be satisfied if I have a little more. He says, that's just the way it is. Don't look to it for your ultimate satisfaction. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. So, what's the advantage to the owners except to look at it? After all, you can only spend so much a day. And the rest that you've gotten, if it hasn't satisfied you because your appetite has increased, what are you going to do with that you've got? Why, you get to look at it. Isn't that wonderful? Verse 12, the sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much. You know why? He's got something to do. He's got work to do. He accomplished something that day so he can sleep well. He contributed something to somebody that day through his work, and he sleeps. That's good. But watch what happens to the rich man. The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach, which is really not yet satisfied, the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. I've got all of this stuff, but it hasn't satisfied me, and my sleep is disturbed. Why? Well, all kinds of reasons. Maybe because the more I get, the more I have to be responsible for, and the more I get, the more I have to manage, and the more I get, the more, and remember that song from Porgy and Bess? I got plenty of nothing, and nothing's plenty for me. And he talks about the rich people, got to put a lock on the door, got to do da-da-da. I don't have a lock in my house. I haven't got anything there. Then what? There is a contentment to being able to work and not have a lot to worry about. The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. Then he says, there's a grievous evil which I've seen under the sun, something that really does not satisfy. Riches being hoarded by their owners to their hurt. There are people who have money they don't need. Don't know anybody like that. Money I don't need. Why would God do that? Well, maybe he wants me to look at it. Why would God give me more than I need? Paul told Timothy, if you've got clothes and you have shelter, you have food, you should be content. Because life is not about accumulation. And if I have more than I need, it just may be that God wants me to share his grace with somebody else. There's a grievous evil which I've seen under the sun, riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt. When these riches were lost through a bad investment, and that's certainly a possibility. When these riches were lost through a bad investment, and he fathered a son, then there was nothing to support him or his son. Because it does happen in the providence of God, it happens that money is lost. It's not forever. And then there's nothing to support. I don't have any money. Well, do you have faith in God? No, I loved money. Do you have confidence that God is watching? No, I don't bother me with that stuff. I needed that money that I could hold that would give me the security and the happiness and would purchase that happiness that I need. He says, when that's gone, and if it's gone, there's nothing. There's nothing for himself. There's nothing to pass on to his kid. I don't have any money, kid. Sorry. Yeah, but Dad, you gave me faith. You gave me confidence in a God who watches over me. It doesn't matter to me so much that you haven't given me a lot of money. No, Dad, you gave me a skill. You showed me how to do something in this life. And maybe I can support you now. But the guy who just focuses on his money, when it's gone, if it's gone, he has nothing of value. I would like to think that our character would have such value that we could pass it on to our kids. I would like we could tell our kids what life really is about, a relationship with God, and that can support them. When these riches were lost through bad investment, he had fathered a son. There was nothing to support him. And as he came naked from his mother's womb, so he will return naked as he came. That's the one thing we all got in common. We didn't bring anything in. We're not taking anything out. And this little tiny speck of 80, 90 years that we live, we spend it, I want to get stuff. Not realizing there's a whole eternity that the line is infinite. It's not this little speck of this life. The line is infinite. Why wouldn't I invest in that? Why wouldn't I invest in a relationship with God? Why wouldn't I help my kids invest in a relationship with God, regardless of 401k? As he came naked from his mother's womb, so he will return as he came. He will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hands. That's where we're all going to end up. I'm going to face a God, and I'm going to have... He's not going to say, but how'd your investments work out? Maybe we'll put them in the heavenly bank. We will stand there naked. And if we don't have faith, if we don't have trust in him, if we don't have love for him, if our life was mostly taken up with just the physical provision, as he came naked from his mother's womb, so he will return. As he came, he will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. And this also is a grievous evil. Exactly as a man is born, that's how he will die. So what's the advantage to him who toils for the wind? It's like, I spent my life trying to amass this cash, and it's like, I tried to amass this wind. You can't. The wind goes, that's what's going to happen to my cash. It's going to, I'm going to stand naked before God. What have I got? Verse 17, throughout his life, he also eats in darkness. His money didn't give him understanding. It's darkness. It didn't draw him closer to God. It didn't create a relationship with God. Throughout his life, he also eats in darkness with great vexation. Your money doesn't exempt you from having problems. You're going to have problems whether you're rich or you're poor. Throughout this life also, he eats in darkness with great vexation, sickness. Sickness isn't going to make you well. You might be able to buy the services of a more skilled physician, but you'll still be sick sometime, some way. With great vexation, sickness, and anger. Anger doesn't make you, money doesn't make you less angry, less judgmental, less rotten person. So here's where we are. If your satisfaction is going to come from government and social institutions, Solomon says, forget it. It's vanity. It's like a dream. It's like smoke. Same thing with money. If you think you will sometime get enough money to be totally, really satisfied, it's just not going to happen because your appetite increases. And it really doesn't bring you that ultimate satisfaction. He says there's one thing that will bring a person genuine ultimate satisfaction in this life, whether they appreciate government or not, whether they're rich or poor. And here it comes. Here's what it is. Verse 18. Here is what I have seen to be good. He's morally good, right? Here is what I have seen to be good and fitting. The idea of fitting is really beautiful and appropriate. He says, and remember, he was the smartest guy that ever lived. He says, I've looked at all of this stuff. I've looked at what governments can supply. I've looked at what money can supply. And here's the one thing I can say. This is good. You can count on this. This is right. This is beautiful. This is the way life ought to be. Oh, I can hardly wait. Here's what I've seen to be good and fitting. To eat, to drink, and enjoy oneself in all one's labors in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life. He said, here's the best thing you can do. Enjoy yourself with what God gives you. You can You can spend your life focusing on money. You can spend your life focusing on the ills of society and how to cure those. The only thing that's going to bring you satisfaction is to say, God, I have what I have. I have this work to do that you've given me. I'm going to enjoy it. Instead of wishing I had that work that you haven't given me. Instead of wishing I had that income that you haven't given me. I can spend my life working for those things, or I can say, what you have given me, I'm going to enjoy. I think a lot of people, myself included, spend entirely too much time living in the future. It's going to be better in the future. Or living in the past, I wish I'd have done this. But what? God says, look what I've given you now. Enjoy it now. That's the thing that's good, and that's the thing that's proper, because you recognize it came from God. Watch this. The last part of verse 18. He says, I want you to eat and drink and enjoy your labor which God's given you. You got to work, yeah, and you're glad you have work. It gives you significance. Look at the last part. Which God has given him, for this is his reward. What's his reward? This word translated reward isn't like reward, something that you earn. It's more properly translated, this is your portion. This is your lot. This is your piece of the pie that God's given you. Enjoy it. You can spend your life worrying about other things, or you could spend your life enjoying what God's given you. The family he's given you now. The moment you have now. The income you have now. Enjoy it. The health you have now. He says it's good and it's beautiful to enjoy it. Don't spend your life living in some other sphere where you have something he hasn't given you. And this is a beautiful thing. This is what we call, theologically, what we call God's providence. Your reward, your piece of the pie, your lot in life that God has given you. A person can say all they want,
well, I earned this. I worked hard for this. Don't tell me it was a gift of God.
Where did you happen to get that drive? Where did you happen to get that ability? Where did you happen to get the eyes to see that you needed? Where did you happen to get the feet to walk to make those deals? All of that stuff that you attribute to your own hard work, where did that come from? And New Testament says, what do you have that God hasn't given you? What do you have that God hasn't given you?
Well, I was the one that went into that meeting and cut that deal.
Yeah, right. Who gave you the brain to cut that deal? Who gave you the instinct to cut that deal? Other people don't have that instinct. Other people don't have that kind of mindset. Where did that come from? Either you take all the credit to yourself or you give all of the credit to God. Now, this last part of this verse, verse 18. What God has given you, we should enjoy it. Which God, this is the last part, which God has given him. For this is his portion. This is his lot that God has given him. This is the providence of God. What? The thing you have now. What you have been given, your life now, this day, is the result not so much of all of the things you can figure out that happened. It is what God has given you. And that's providence. Providence is a concept that God is involved in everything. And he brings us to where we are all through our lives. Let me give you a beautiful picture of providence. Ezekiel says he had a vision, and there was this vast nothingness. And under this, there was something above that vast nothingness, and under that vast nothingness, there was fire, and there was lightning, and there were four living creatures. Oh, this is a beautiful. I wish I'd have written it. Four living creatures had a face of a man, had a face of a lion, had a face of a bull, had a face of an eagle. And these four creatures fly around. And each of these four creatures that see everything and fly around have the Spirit of God. And each of these four creatures that have the Spirit of God have a wheel. I want to show you a picture of that wheel. This is the oldest photograph ever taken back in Ezekiel's time, even before there were cameras. Either that or this is an artist's depiction. Each of these four creatures have a wheel. And that wheel has another wheel inside of it, kind of like a gyroscope. And on the rim of those wheels are eyes, all around the rim of those eyes. You know what this is a picture of? You know who he told about this vision? He told it to the children of Israel who were slaves. They were in bondage to Babylonia, and they had no hope of ever getting out. Well, what's this crazy vision of all this fire, and in this fire, these four living creatures, and each one of these four living creatures having these wheels along with them. And it says that the Spirit of God was in these living creatures and in these wheels. Notice what they do. Listen, I'll read from Ezekiel chapter 1, beginning with verse 15. Now, I looked at the living beings. Behold, there was one wheel on the earth inside the living beings for each of the four of them. Each one of these four beasts had a wheel inside of him that looked something like that. The appearance of the wheels and their workmanship was like sparkling beryl, and all four of them had the same form. Their appearance and their workmanship being as one wheel was in another wheel. Wherever they moved in any of the four directions without turning, they moved. And as for their rims, they were lofty and awesome, and the rims of all the four of them were full of eyes round about. And whenever the living beings moved, the wheels moved with them. And whenever the living beings rose from the earth, the wheels rose also. And whether the spirit was about to go, they would go in that direction. And all the wheels were close beside them, for the spirit of the living beings were in the wheels. Whenever those went there, the wheels went, and whenever those stood still, these stood still, and whenever those rose from the earth, the wheels rose close behind them, for the spirit of the living beings was in the wheels. Well, that's something you tell somebody who's in slavery, isn't it? What does that mean? It means this. God is very mobile. And he uses his angelic beings, or he uses himself directly, just like the wheels. These four living creatures are symbolic of the providence of God, the activity of God. And when the beings rose up, the wheels rose up. And when the beings moved this way, the wheels moved this way. And when the beings moved this way, the wheels moved that way with them. That's telling these people who were slaves, God is everywhere, and he's particularly now here with you. And nothing happens that escapes his all the eyes that are in those wheels. Nothing happens to you that he's not aware of. Nothing happens to you that he has not ordained. His living creatures, his wheels, are his providence, his activity in your life. And he's involved in it every single day, every single second. Have hope. You know why I talk so much about the providence of God? It's because the Bible talks so much about the providence of God. And these wheels are a beautiful vision that he wanted to give the most desperate people. God is at work. Remember, we saw last week that it says, you're on the earth and he's in heaven. You can only see, you know, around here. He sees everything, and he ordains and he works everything for your benefit because he loves you. And if you look to government, you won't get that assurance. And if you look to money, you won't get that assurance. They're both temporary and they're both extremely unreliable. But if you look to providence, what's providence? Providence is God's activity in your life. And that vision of Ezekiel assured those people. Nothing happens that the eyes do not see. Nothing happens that the wheels did not bring about. Because in those wheels and in those beings was the very Spirit of God himself. That's how active he is in your life. Next time you get down and think God's abandoned you and you don't have any hope, have a vision of the wheel. Oh, it's right here. It's right here with me. Back to Ecclesiastes. Verse 19. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward, receive his lot, receive his portion, and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. Here's the gift of God. You know what the gift of God is? His wheels have hovered over you, and they have said, I want you here at this time, in this place, in these circumstances. I, the wise, infinitely wise, and the infinitely loving God, have put you here. Eat what you can. Drink what you can. Enjoy what I've given you. And don't worry. Every time I say that, you know, somebody's going to hear, oh, don't give a flip about anything. Don't worry. I'm here. Just the way these beings, and it says these beings, their wings touched. They were so huge, their wings touched, and they covered the whole universe. You are under those wings. And you are being affected by the rotation of those wheels, the working of God's will in your life. Eat what he's given you. Drink what he's given you. And don't seek your contentment in what government can supply or what money can supply. It just isn't there. Where is it? It's in providence. It's in knowing God's wheels are at work in the universe and in my dinky little life. Because he loves me. This is, Solomon says, the gift of God. Verse 20. For he, that's the one who is eating and drinking and accepting what God has given him with joy, he will not often consider the years of his life. In other words, he's not worrying. He's not going to say, gee, I wish my past had been this way. Or gee, I hope my future is this way. And even the present, you know, this present stinks. He says, a person who realizes the providence of God is at work isn't concerned about it. They're just enjoying what God has given them. At this moment, in this time, there's a great book called The Sacrament of the Present Moment. And the idea of it is you just receive what God gives you and you're grateful to him. And you don't end up with a life that is just inward and built on what you thought you could do. And you can't pass it on to anybody. But your faith in this wonderful God whose providence is looking over you every minute of your life, you receive and you eat what he gives and you drink what he gives and you're thankful to him right now. And the past is all over. And he's forgiven you of the past. And the future is what he's designed for your good. And the present is meant for you to enjoy. You know, this whole book of Ecclesiastes, I think, has a theme of without God, life is meaningless. And I think nothing points it up more than this passage. For he will not often consider the years of his life because God keeps him occupied with the goodness of his heart, with the gladness of his heart. If I will focus on God and his providence, my heart will be glad and my life will be focused on that. And I'm not overly concerned about the past or the future. I am enjoying the present God has given us. You know, I'm sure a sermon like this raises a lot of questions. But and I'm not going to take time to entertain those, but I just want you to know that I really believe that. I really do believe that contentment is found one place, permanent, lasting. Peace of mind and heart is found one place, and that's in appreciating and receiving God's providence. What is that? Where you are right now. Well, where I am right now is very difficult. I know. And he means it for your good. He doesn't mean it to hurt you. He loves you. And you can be worried and confused and upset. But if you want to be content, receive what he gives you. And enjoy it. He loves you. Heavenly Father, our flesh wants so very much to fix everything. If you'd save us from that, we wouldn't waste our lives. Our flesh, Father, wants so much, and we all feel it, wants so much to make the plans and do the things that will ensure our contentment. By your grace, we will listen to one much wiser than we are, who just told us, enjoy what you, Father, have given us. Help us do that day by day, moment by moment. Appreciate your providence, because it covers everything, including us, and we're so very everlastingly grateful. If we can make progress, it will be because you have helped us. In the name of Christ, we pray. Amen.